What happened in 9/11 is we didn't have a strategy, we didn't have bipartisan agreement, we didn't have American understanding of it, and we had instead a policy coup in this country. A coup. A policy coup. Some hard-nosed people took over the direction of American policy, and they never bothered to inform the rest of us. I went through the Pentagon 10 days after 9/11. I couldn't stay away from Mother Army. I went back there to see Don Rumsfeld. I'd worked for him as a White House fellow in the 1970s. All this is in the book. And I said, am I doing okay on CNN? He said, yeah, fine. He said, I'm thinking about it. He says, I read your book. And he said, this is a book that talks about the Kosovo campaign. And he said, I just want to tell you, he said, nobody's going to tell us where or when we can bomb. Nobody. He said, I'm thinking of calling this a floating coalition. What do you think about that? I said, well, sir, thanks for reading my book. And, he said, thanks, that's all the time I've got. Really? And I went downstairs. I was leaving the Pentagon, and an officer from the Joint Staff called me into his office and said, I want you to know, he said, sir, we're going to attack Iraq. And I said, why? He said, we don't know. He said, I said, well, did they tie Saddam to 9/11? He said, no. He said, but I guess it's they don't know what to do about terrorism, and so they think, but they can attack states, and they want to look strong, and so I guess they think if they take down a state, it will intimidate the terrorists, and you know, it's like that old saying, he said, if the only tool you have is a hammer, then every problem has to be a nail. Well, I walked out of there pretty upset. And then we attacked Afghanistan. I was pretty happy about that. We should have. And then I came back to the Pentagon about 6 weeks later. I saw the same officer. I said, why haven't we attacked Iraq? We still going to attack Iraq? He said, oh, sir. He says, it's worse than that. He said, he pulled up a piece of paper off his desk. He said, I just got this memo from the Secretary of Defense's office that says we're going to attack and destroy the governments in seven countries in 5 years. We're going to start with Iraq, and then we're going to move to Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Iran. I said, seven countries in 5 years. I said, is that a classified memo? He said, yes, sir. I said, well, don't show it to me. He was about to show it to me. He said, because I want to talk about it. And I sat on this information for a long time, for about 6 or 8 months. I was so stunned by this, I couldn't begin to talk about it. And I couldn't believe it would really be true, but that's actually what happened. These people took control of the policy in the United States. And I realized then, it came back to me, a 1991 meeting I had with Paul Wolfowitz. You know, in 2001, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense, but in 1991, he was the Under Secretary of Defense for Policy. It's the number three position in the Pentagon. And I had gone to see him when I was a one-star general. I was commanding the National Training Center. I had met him one time. He said, if you ever get to Washington, come look me up. They always say that. Well, I was there in Washington. It was a Friday afternoon. I'd visited Colin Powell. He'd given me 5 minutes of his precious time and sent me on my way, and I was bored in the Pentagon, and I thought, I'll just go, who can I see? I think I'll see Wolfowitz. So I called, and up there, he was available. Scooter Libby came to the door. I met Scooter for the first time, and he brought me in. And I said to Paul, and this is 1991, I said, Mr. Secretary, you must be pretty happy with the performance of the troops in Desert Storm. And he said, well, yeah, he said, but not really. He said, because the truth is we should have gotten rid of Saddam Hussein, and we didn't. And this was just after the Shia uprising in March of 91, which we had provoked, and then we kept our troops on the sidelines and didn't intervene. And he said, but one thing we did learn, he said, we learned that we can use our military in the region, in the Middle East, and the Soviets won't stop us. He said, and we've got about 5 or 10 years to clean up those old Soviet client regimes, Syria, Iran, Iraq, before the next great superpower comes on to challenge us. And it was like, you know, I'm coming out of the Mojave Desert. I've been training troops. I haven't been thinking geostrategy for some time. And suddenly, a guy just sort of shoves this nugget at you. Well, you remember it. It was a pretty stunning thing. You mean the purpose of the military is to start wars and change governments? It's not to sort of deter conflict? We're going to invade countries? And, I you know, my mind was spinning. And I put that aside. It was like a nugget that you hold on to. This country was taken over by a group of people with a policy coup. Wolfowitz and Cheney and Rumsfeld, and you could name a half dozen other collaborators from the Project for a New American Century. They wanted us to destabilize the Middle East, turn it upside down, make it under our control. It went back to those comments in 1991. Now, did anybody ever tell you that? Was there a national dialogue on this? Did senators and congressmen stand up and denounce this plan? Was there a full-fledged American debate on it? Absolutely not. And there still isn't. And that's why we're failing in Iraq. Because Iran and Syria know about the plan. All you have to do is read the Weekly Standard and listen to Bill Kristol, and he blabbermouths it all over the world. Richard Pearl the same way. They could hardly wait to finish Iraq so they could move into Syria. It was like a laydown. Oh, our legions are going to go in there. This wasn't what the American people voted George Bush into office. Well, they didn't actually vote him into office, but it wasn't what many of the people who... It wasn't what he campaigned on. He campaigned on a humble foreign policy, the most arrogant foreign policy in American history. He campaigned on no peacekeeping, no nation building, and here he is with Afghanistan and Iraq. It's astonishing. So the root of the problem is not how many troops are in Iraq. Please believe me. Don't be mad if you're a Democrat at your Democratic congressman because they can't reduce the troops and frustrate the president. That's not the issue. And if you're a Republican, don't be mad at the Democrats because they're fussing with the troops. Whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, if you're an American, you ought to be concerned about the strategy of the United States in this region. What is our aim? What is our purpose? Why are we there? Why are Americans dying in this region? That is the issue.
If we were just resorting to that and we didn't have a realistic view that there are bad people out there who are trying to do us harm and we've got to have the strongest military in the world and we occasionally have to twist the arms of countries that wouldn't do what we need them to do if it weren't for the various economic or diplomatic or in some cases military leverage that we had, if we didn't have that dose of realism, we wouldn't get anything done either. So what I do think is accurate in describing my foreign policy is a strong belief that we don't have military solutions to every problem in the 21st century. We don't have a peer in terms of a state that's going to attack us, invade us. The closest we have, obviously, is Russia with its nuclear arsenal, but generally speaking, they can't project the way we can around the world. China can't either. We spend more on our military than the next 10 countries combined. The biggest challenge that we have right now is disorder, failed states.
My name is Nick Brand. I'm the Director of Corporate Programs at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and thank you all for joining us this evening. I'd like to take this opportunity to welcome George Friedman to the Chicago Council. I believe it's his first time here, so thank you so much for being with us.
The United States has a fundamental interest. It controls all the oceans of the world. No power has ever done that. Because of that, we get to invade people, and they don't get to invade us. It's a very nice thing. Maintaining control of the sea and control of space is the foundation of our power. The best way to defeat an enemy fleet is to not let it be built. The way the British managed to make certain that no European power could build a fleet was to make sure the Europeans were at each other's throats. The policy that I would recommend is the one that Ronald Reagan adopted toward Iran and Iraq. He funded both sides so they would fight each other and not fight us. This was cynical. It was certainly not moral. It worked. And this is the point. The United States cannot occupy Eurasia. The moment the first boot sets the ground, the demographic differential is we are totally outnumbered. We can defeat an army. We cannot occupy Iraq. The idea that 130,000 men would occupy a country of 25 million, well, the ratio in New York of cops to citizens was greater than we had deployed in Iraq. So we don't have the ability to go across, but we do have the ability to first support various contending powers so they concentrate in themselves with political support, some economic support, military support, advisors, and in extremis, do what we did in Japan, in Vietnam, in Iraq, and in Afghanistan, spoiling attacks. The spoiling attack is not intended to defeat the enemy. It's intended to throw him off balance. What we did in each of these wars, in Afghanistan, for example, is we threw al-Qaeda off balance. The problem we have, since we're young and stupid, is that having thrown them off balance, instead of saying, okay, job well done, let's go home, we said, well, that was easy. Why don't we build a democracy here? This was the moment of dementia that came in. The answer, therefore, is the United States cannot constantly be intervening throughout Eurasia. It must be selectively intervening and very rarely. That is the extreme moment. We cannot, as the first step, send American troops. And when we send American troops, we have to clearly understand what the mission is, limit it to that, and not develop all sorts of psychotic fantasies. So hopefully we've learned that this time. It takes a while for kids to learn lessons. But I think you're absolutely right. We cannot, as an empire, do that. Britain didn't occupy India. It took various Indian states and turned them against each other and provided some British officers for an Indian army. The Romans did not send vast armies out there. It placed kings like, various kings created under the emperor, and those kings were responsible for maintaining the peace. Pontius Pilate was an example. So empires that are directly governed by the empire, like the Nazi empire, fail. No one has that much power. You have to have a level of cleverness. However, our problem is not yet that. It is actually admitting that we have an empire. So we haven't even gotten to that point where we don't think we can kind of go home and it'll be over and done. And so we're not even ready for chapter 3 of the book. The primordial interest of the United States, over which for a century we have fought wars, the First, Second Cold War, has been the relationship between Germany and Russia, because united they are the only force that could threaten us, and to make sure that that doesn't happen. For the United States, the primordial fear is Russian capital, Russian technology, I mean German technology and German capital, Russian natural resources, Russian manpower, as the only combination that has for centuries scared the hell out of the United States. So how does this play out? Well, the U.S. has already put its cards on the table. It is the line from the Baltics to the Black Sea.